One of them was out in the middle of the lagoon, tearing a snowy ostrich feather of wake from the surface as it ran at speed. A tiny figure towed on skis behind it lifted an arm and waved a greeting. Peter thought it might be her, but at that moment the Tri-Islander banked steeply onto its base leg, and he was left with only a view of cumulus cloud, bloodied by the setting sun. The runway was short and narrow, hacked from the palm plantation on the strip of level land between beach and hills. It was surfaced with crushed coral. They made their final approach over a tall palisade of palm trees. Peter saw that the pilot had not exaggerated by calling it a little difficult. There was a spiteful crosswind rolling in and breaking over the hills, and it rocked the Tri-Islander's wings sickeningly. The pilot crabbed her in, heading half into the wind, and as he skimmed in over the palm tops, closed the throttles, kicked her straight with the rudders, lowered a wing into the wind to hold her from drifting, and dropped her neatly 50 feet over the threshold, perfectly aligned with the short runway. So she kissed and sat down solidly. Instantly, the pilot whipped the wheel to full lock into the crosswind to prevent a ground loop and brought her up short. "Parfait!" Peter grunted with involuntary admiration. And the man looked slightly startled, as though the feat deserved no special mention. Baroness Altman employed only the very best. There was an electric golf cart, driven by a young Polynesian girl, waiting at the end of the strip amongst the palm trees. She wore only a pareo, wrapped around her body below the armpits, a single length of crimson and gold-patterned cloth that fell to mid-thigh. Her feet were bare, but around her pretty head she wore a crown of fresh flowers, the maver of the islands. She drove the golf cart at a furious pace along narrow winding tracks through the gardens that were a rare collection of exotic plants skilfully laid out so that there was an exquisite surprise around each turn of the path. His bungalow was above the beach with white sand below the veranda and the ocean stretching to the horizon, secluded as though it were the only building on the island. Like a child, the island girl took his hand, a gesture of perfect innocence, and led him through the bungalow, showing him the controls for the air conditioning, lighting, and the video screen, explaining it all in lisping French patois and giggling at his expression of pleasure. There was a fully stocked bar and kitchenette. The small library contained all the current bestsellers, and the newspapers and magazines were only a few days old. The offerings on the video screen included half a dozen recent successful features and Oscar winners. "Hell, Robinson Crusoe should have landed here," Peter chuckled, and the girl giggled and wriggled like a friendly little puppy in sympathy. She came to fetch him again 2 hours later, after he had showered and shaved and rested and changed into a light cotton tropical suit with open shirt and sandals. Again she held his hand, and Peter sensed that if a man had taken the gesture as license, the girl would have been hurt and confused. By the hand, she led him along a path that was demarcated by cunningly concealed glow lights, and the night was filled with a murmur of the ocean and the gentle rustle and clatter of palm fronds moving in the wind. Then they came to the long ship-roofed building he had seen from the air. There was soft music and laughter, but when he stepped into the light, the laughter stopped, and half a dozen figures turned to him expectantly. Peter was not sure what he had expected, but it was not this gay social gathering, tanned men and women in expensive and elegant casual wear, holding tall frosted glasses filled with ice and fruit. "Peter!" Magda Altman broke from the group and came to him with that gliding, hip-swinging walk. She wore a soft, shimmering, wheaten gold dress, held high at the throat with a thin gold chain, but completely nude across the shoulders and down her back to within an inch of the cleft of her buttocks. It was breathtaking, for her body was smooth as a rose petal and tanned to the colour of new honey. The dark hair was twisted into a rope as thick as her wrist and piled up onto the top of her head, and she had touched her eyes with shadows, so they were slanting and green and mysterious. "Peter," she repeated, and kissed him lightly upon the lips, a brush like a moth's wing, and her perfume touched him softly, the fragrance of quadrille flowering with the warmth and magic of her body. He felt his senses tilt. With all he knew of her, yet he was still not hardened to her physical presence. She was cool and groomed and poised as she had ever been. There was no trace at all of the confusion and fearsome loneliness that he had heard in those muffled, choked-down sobs from halfway across the world. Not until she stepped back to tilt her head on one side, surveying him swiftly, smiling lightly. "Oh, chérie, you're looking so much better. I was so worried about you when last I saw you." Only then, he thought, he was able to detect the shadows deep in her eyes, and the tightness at the corners of her mouth. "And you are more beautiful than I remembered." It was true, so he could say it without reserve, and she laughed, a single soft purr of pleasure. "You never said that before," she reminded him. But still her manner was brittle. Her show of affection and friendliness might have convinced him at another time, but not now. "And I am grateful." Now she took his arm, her fingers in the crook of his elbow, and she led him to the waiting group of guests, as though she did not trust herself to be alone with him another moment, lest she reveal some forbidden part of herself. There were three men and their wives, an American Democrat senator of considerable political influence, a man with a magnificent head of silver hair, eyes like dead oysters, and a beautiful wife at least 30 years his junior, who looked at Peter the way a lion looks at a gazelle, and held his hand seconds longer than was necessary. There was an Australian, heavy in the shoulder and big in the gut. His skin was tanned leathery, and his eyes were framed in a network of wrinkles. They seemed to be staring through dust and sun glare at distant horizons. He owned a quarter of the world's known uranium reserves, and cattle stations whose area was twice the size of the British Isles. His wife was as tanned, and her handshake was as firm as his. The third man was a Spaniard, whose family name was synonymous with sherry, an urbane and courtly don, but with that fierce Moorish rake to his thin features. Peter had read somewhere that the sherry and cognac aging in this man's cellars was valued at over $500 million, and that formed only a small part of his family's investments. His wife was a darkly brooding Spanish beauty, with an extraordinary streak of chalk white through the peak of her otherwise black hair. As soon as the group had assimilated Peter, the talk turned back easily to the day's sport. The Australian had boated a huge black marlin that morning, a fish over 1,000 pounds in weight and 15 feet from the point of its bill to the tip of its deep sickle tail, and the company was elated. Peter took little part in the conversation, but watched Magda Altman covertly. Yet she was fully aware of his scrutiny. He could see it in the way she held her hand and the tension in her whole long, slim body. But she laughed easily with the others and glanced at Peter only once or twice, each time with a smile, but the shadows were in the green depths of her eyes. Finally, she clapped her hands. "Come, everybody. We are going to open the feast." She linked arms with the senator and the Australian, and led them down onto the beach. Peter was left to cope with the senator's wife, who pushed her bosom against his upper arm and ran her tongue lightly over her lips as she clung to him. Two of the Polynesian servants were waiting beside a long mound of white beach sand, and at Magda's signal they attacked it with shovels, swiftly exposing a thick layer of seaweed and banana leaves, from which poured columns of thick and fragrant steam. Below that was a rack of banyan wood and palm fronds, which suspended the feast over another layer of seaweed and live coals. There were exclamations of delight as the aroma of chicken and fish and pork mingled with those of breadfruit and plantains and spices. "Ah, a success," Magda declared gaily. "If any air is allowed to enter the bake, we lose it all. It burns, poof, and we're left with only charcoal." While they feasted and drank, the talk and laughter became louder and less restrained. But Peter made the single drink last the evening and waited quietly, not joining the conversation and ignoring the blandishments of the senator's wife. He was waiting for some indication of when and from what direction it would come. Not here, he knew, not in this company. When it came, it would be swift and efficient, as everything else that Caliph did. And suddenly he wondered at his own conceit, that had allowed him to walk, entirely unarmed and unsupported, into the arena selected and prepared by his enemy. He knew his best defence was to strike first, perhaps this very night if the opportunity offered. The sooner the safer, he realised, and Magda smiled at him across the table, set under the palm trees and laden with enough food to feed 50. When he smiled back at her, she beckoned with a slight inclination of her head. And then, while the men argued and bantered loudly, she murmured an apology to the women and slipped unobtrusively into the shadows. Peter gave her a count of 50 before he followed her. She was waiting along the beach. He saw the flash of her bare, smooth back in the moonlight, and he went forward to where she stood, staring out across the wind-ruffled waters of the lagoon. He came up behind her, and she didn't turn her head, but her voice was a whisper. "I'm so glad you came, Peter. I'm so glad you asked me to." He touched the back of her neck, just behind her ear. The ear had an almost elfin point to it that he hadn't noticed before, and the upswept hair at her nape was silken under his fingertips. He could just locate the axis, that delicate bone at the base of the skull which the hangman aims to crush with a drop. He could do it with the pressure of thumb, and it would be as quick as the knot. "I'm so sorry about the others," she said, "but I'm getting rid of them, with almost indecent haste, I'm afraid." She reached up over her shoulder and took his hand from her neck, and he didn't resist. Gently she spread the hand, and then pressed the open palm to her cheek. "They will leave early tomorrow. Pierre is flying them back to Papeete, and then we will have Les Neuf Poissons to ourselves, just you and I." And then that husky little chuckle, and 30-odd servants. He could understand exactly why it would be that way. The only witnesses would be the faithful retainers of the Grande Dame of the Islands. "Now we must go back. Unfortunately, my guests are very important, and I cannot ignore them longer. But tomorrow will come. Too slowly for me, Peter, but it will come." She turned in the circle of his arms and kissed him with a sudden startling ferocity, so his lips were crushed against his teeth, and then she broke from him and whispered closely to his ear. "Whatever way it goes, Peter, we have had something of value, you and I. Perhaps the most precious thing I have had in my life. They can never take that away from me." And then she was out of his arms, with that uncanny speed and grace of movement, and gliding back along the path towards the lights. He followed her slowly, confused and uncertain as to what she had meant by those last words, concluding finally that the purpose had been exactly that, to confuse and unbalance him. And at that moment he sensed rather than heard movement behind him, and instantly whirled and ducked. The man was 10 paces behind him, had come like a leopard, silently from the cover of a fall of lianas and flowering creepers beside the path. Only some animal instinct had warned Peter, and his body flowed into the fighting stance, balanced, strung like a nocked arrow, at once ready both to attack and meet attack. "Good evening, General Stride." Peter only just managed to arrest himself, and he straightened slowly, but with each hand still extended stiffly at his side like the blade of a meat cleaver, and as lethal. "Carl," he said. So the grey wolves had been close, within feet of them, guarding their mistress even in that intimate moment. "I hope I did not alarm you," said the bodyguard, and though Peter could not see the man's expression, there was a faint mockery in his voice. If there was confirmation needed, complete and final, this was it. Only Caliph would have need of a guard on a romantic assignment. Peter knew then, beyond any doubt, that either he or Magda Altman would be dead by sunset the following evening.